Compared to sliding the sled along the snow, this was several times harder. And maybe the worst part, it was harsh and bumpy for Ashley, which meant painful, and slower by a large margin. I didn't see any other way. I pulled out the last of our food and split it with her. Here, this might take your mind off the pain, but go easy. This is the last of it. I ate my three pieces, which only made me more hungry. I strapped the sled higher on the harness, buckled myself in, and put one foot in front of the other. I readjusted the straps, then did it again. And again. I didn't stop until I could go no further. I remember knee-deep snow, stumbling 1,000 times, crawling on my elbows, pulling at tree trunks with my blistered and frozen hands, and the quagmire of more snow than I'd ever hoped to see. I remember walking through the afternoon, through dusk, through the first of night when the moon rose. I remember it shining down and casting my shadow on the snow. I remember starlight and then low clouds moving in. I remember blowing bitter cold breath, and I remember walking a while longer. The compass dangled about me. I held it in my palm, let it settle, and just kept following the arrow. Bright green and glowing in the dark. Rachel had paid $100 for it a decade ago. Now it was worth $10,000. I woke up face down in the snow. It was pitch dark, no moon, no stars, and my right cheek was cold, but, thanks to my beard, not frozen. My hands had cramped from holding on to the front of the sled behind me, trying to prevent Ashley's head from beating about. The straps were cutting into my shoulders, and I couldn't really feel my legs. I stood, pushed into the snow, and sank for the 10,000th time up to my thighs. I had stayed warm because I'd kept moving, but I could move no more, and my core was cold. Ashley was either asleep or unconscious. I unbuckled, lifted the harness over my head, crawled beneath an evergreen, kicked away the snow to make a flat section wide enough for two people, and pulled Ashley in underneath. I rolled out my bag, stripped, and climbed inside. The tunnel narrowed, and I realized that I did not expect to wake up. Chapter 28. The sun was high when I opened my eyes. I was sore in places I'd forgotten were part of my body. I wasn't hungry, but I was so weak that I didn't want to move. Other than a few crumbs, our food was gone. My face felt tight, sunburned. My lips were peeling, and my too-weak beard offered little protection against the reflective burn of the sun. I picked up my head, rolled over, and took a look around. Ashley was looking at me. Her eyes spoke two things, compassion and resolution, as in resolved to the fate we faced. Even Napoleon looked weak. My clothes lay in a crumpled wet pile next to me. The reality of last night returned in a wave of hopelessness. Ashley leaned over me, a strip of meat in her hand. Eat. Spread across her lap, wrapped in the cups of her bra, lay several strips of meat. My thinking was cloudy. It didn't register. Where'd you get it? She tapped my lip. Eat. I opened my mouth. She set a small bite on my tongue, and I began to chew. It was tough, cold, mostly sinew, and may have been the best thing I'd ever put in my mouth. I swallowed, and she tapped my lip again. We didn't have that much food yesterday. Where'd you... Clarity came with a rush. I shook my head. She tapped me again. Eat this, and don't argue with me.
You first.
A tear dripped off her face. You need this. You still have a chance.
We've had this discussion.
But... I pulled myself up on one elbow and reached out to grab her hand. You want to die out here alone? Let the cold creep in and take you? I shook my head. Dying alone is no way to die. Her hand was trembling. But...
No buts.
Why? She threw the gnarly piece of meat at me. It ricocheted off my shoulder and landed on the snow. Napoleon jumped up and devoured it. Her voice echoed off the mountains, rising up around us.
Why are you doing this? We're not going to make it.
I don't know if we're going to make it or not, but either we are or we are not. I shook my head. No other option.
But...
She turned, pointed.
If you kept going, you might see something, find something.
What if it got you one step closer to finding a way out? Ashley, I will not live the rest of my life staring at your face every time I close my eyes. She curled up, crying. I sat up, staring at my frozen clothes. The only thing warm and dry was my jacket. I needed to take a look around, figure out where we were. I pulled on my long underwear, then my pants, sinking my feet back into my boots. My feet were badly blistered. Sliding them in was painful, but not as painful as those first few steps. I pulled my jacket on over my bare skin. If I could keep my core warm and not sweat, I'd be okay. We slept in the open and were lucky it had not snowed. I turned in a circle studying the top of the bowl-like valley in which we'd walked. I needed to get a bird's-eye view. Dark, heavy clouds were spilling in across the mountains to the north. I wasn't sure how long the snow would hold off. I knelt next to her and touched her shoulder. Her face was buried in her bag. I'm going to look around. One of the unique things about the trees around us were the limbs. They were straight, sturdy, started near the ground, and were spaced like ladder rungs up the trunks. I walked 100 yards or so, found one I thought I could climb, slipped off my boots, pulled up, and started climbing. I was tired, my muscles ached, and my arms were telling me I weighed 1,000 pounds. At 30 feet, I took a look around. I was amazed at how far we'd come since the evergreen shelter of yesterday. The ridgeline off which we'd seen the valley and made our decision lay a long way behind us. We traveled nearly the whole valley, maybe 8 to 10 miles. That meant we had to be close. I cupped my hands around my eyes. We needed a break. We were due one. Come on. Please be something. Being down in the valley changed our perspective, which was part of the reason it took me a few minutes to find it. Once I did, I actually laughed. I pulled out my compass, checked my reading, turned the bezel to mark the degree, because I was tired and chances were good I'd forget or get confused, and climbed down. Ashley was weak and wouldn't look at me. The resignation had grown. I stuffed my bag into the backpack, strapped everything onto the sled, and buckled myself into the harness. Doing so took energy I didn't have. The first step sent pain spasms through me. The second was worse. By the 10th, I was numb, which was good. I hadn't peed since yesterday, and given the amount that I'd sweated in the last 24 hours, I was dehydrated. I stuffed a Nalgene bottle with snow and handed it to Ashley. I need you to hold this. Try and melt it for me, okay? I've got to try and get some fluid in me. The snow was wet, thick, and I felt more like a plow than a man walking. The trees obscured my view, so I had to trust the compass. Every few feet I'd stop, check my bearings, pick a tree a short distance away, walk to it, pick another, and so on. Every 10 minutes I'd turn, ask for the canister, and take 2 or 3 sips. That continued for 2 or 3 hours. When we finally broke through the tree line, the snow started in earnest. Quarter-sized flakes, some as big as half dollars. The frozen lake spread out before us, stretching an oval mile toward the mountains that rose up behind it. The snow obscured my vision, but the sight at the other end was one of the more beautiful things I'd ever seen. I collapsed, hit my knees, and tried to catch my breath. My wheezing was deep and my ribs were throbbing. Lying in the sled, Ashley was facing away, continually looking behind us. That's the nature of a gurney. She needed to see this. I crawled around, elbow deep in snow, and spun the sled. Her head was laid back and eyes closed. I tapped her on the shoulder.
Hey, you awake?
She stared at me.
Ben, I'm sorry.
I put my fingers to her lips and pointed across the lake. She craned her eyes, staring through the snow, which was thickening. When she tilted her head and the picture made sense, she started crying. Chapter 29. It was late afternoon, 4:17 to be exact. I just finished up in surgery and returned to my office when my nurse said, "Your wife's waiting on you." You never just appeared, and you never waited on me.
"She is?" I asked.
They nodded but said nothing. They knew. I walked in and you were looking at a color wheel, one of those things that looked like a fan, maybe 2 inches thick, 8 inches long, and covered with rows of every shade of every color in the spectrum. You were staring at it, hand on your chin, looking at it, then up at the wall, back at the color wheel, and then back at the wall.
"Hey," you said.
I pulled the blue booties off my feet and threw them in the trash.
"What are you doing here?"
You held the fan thing up to the wall. "I like this blue. What do you think?" A masculine striped pattern papered the wall. The wallpaper you'd picked out a year earlier when we'd done my office. I ran my hand along the paper.
"I still really like this."
You were in another world. You flipped to another section of the fan. "Of course, we could use this tan, too." I scratched my head.
"You like it better than this $67 a square yard paper we picked out last year?"
You picked up a catalog off my desk, flipped open to a paper-clip page. "And I like this color of wood. It's masculine, yet not too dark. It's something we can grow with." I looked around my office at the $6,000 worth of swanky, fashionable, modern office furniture we'd bought in San Marco about the same time we'd papered the walls. I began thinking about the money we could make if we sold all that stuff on Craigslist. I said nothing. Then you pulled out a large portfolio, like those large briefcases that designers carry their drawings in. You laid it open across my desk, then started flipping through several prints you had on loan from Stellar's gallery.
"These,"
you pointed, tapping each one,
"I like.
They remind me of Norman Rockwell, and then there are a few Ford Rileys and even a Campe." You shook your head. "I know they're each different, but I like them all." You chewed on a fingernail. "I just don't know if we have the wall space for all of them."
"Honey."
You looked at me, eyebrows raised. Your facial expression told me it made total sense to you. Admittedly, I was tired and had been on my feet for 12 hours, 4 surgeries, one that almost went south. "What in the world are you talking about?" You said it so matter-of-factly. "The nursery." Your words echoed through my office in slow motion.
"Nursery."
I remember thinking, didn't they have one of those in Peter Pan?
"Ben,"
you tapped me on the shoulder. "Honey, have you been listening to anything I've been saying?" Maybe a dumb look crossed my face because you took my hand, slid it beneath your shirt, and pressed my palm to your stomach.
"The nursery."
If that other night during the storm you held back the waves, lifted me to the surface and filled my lungs with air, then in this moment, leaning against my desk, color swatches and prints scattered around, my hand pressed to your stomach, your butterflies fluttering beneath my palm, you took my breath away. Chapter 30. I couldn't risk walking across the middle. I had a pretty good feeling the lake was frozen several feet deep, but I had no way of knowing. So I kept to the shoreline. It was flat, free of debris, and the easiest walking to date. In comparison, it felt like we were speeding. The distance to the far shore was nearly a mile. We crossed it in a little over 30 minutes. I pulled her up the small incline and into the trees that lined the bank. Again, I turned her so we could both look. The A-frame construction rose up some 40 feet in the air. The front of it, facing the lake, was entirely glass. A few of the shingles on the roof were missing, but on the whole, the building was doing fairly well. The front door faced the lake, had been painted yellow, and because the prevailing winds came from behind the building, it was only half covered with snow. I pulled the sled up to the front door and spent several minutes pulling away the snow and making a ramp. The door was tall and thick and looked imposing. I grabbed the hatchet and was about to strike the lock when Ashley spoke. "Why don't you see if it's unlocked first?" I pushed on the door and it swung easily on its hinges. The supports for the A-frame were built entirely of lodgepole pine. The floor was concrete, and inside the building was one huge room, nearly as large as a basketball court. On the sides, the roof went all the way to the floor, and the only windows were the ones at either end. A fireplace, big enough for two people to sleep in, sat off to our right. A huge iron grate filled the middle. Stacked 10 feet high in the corner sat a pile of wood that could supply the two of us for an entire winter, maybe 6 or 7 truckloads. Beyond that, down the center of the building, 2 dozen pews, all worn and faded, were mounted on top of one another. Several silver canoes lay atop the pews, awaiting summer and the thaw. Off to the left was a kitchen area, and at the far end, a set of stairs rose to the second floor. The second floor took up only half the length of the building and was open to the area above the fireplace. Huge, forearm-thick cables hung from the apex of the building and supported the floor, which was made of 1-inch plywood and cross timbers. Constructed across the length of the second story were 50 or 60 bunk beds, all covered with carvings, pencil drawings, and every manner of name and lettering detailed who loved who. A squirrel had eaten a pine cone in the middle of the floor and left a mess, and something else had chewed on a piece of styrofoam and didn't clean up after itself. Along the windowsill lay 100 dead flies, wasps, and other flying insects. A good layer of dust covered most everything, and there were no lights and no light switches. Napoleon hopped off the sled, ran down into the room, barked again, then turned in 4 circles and returned to me, wagging his tail and snotting all over my leg. Slowly, I pulled the sled down the ramp and onto the concrete floor. We stared, awestruck. I pulled Ashley over to the fireplace and began stacking wood for a fire. Then I scoured the place for anything small to start the fire. I started laughing when I found a box of fat lighter next to the pile of wood. I built the fire, small sticks on the bottom, larger pieces on top, tore strips of old newspaper out of an old box, and then pulled my bow drill out of the sled and began working the spindle across the hearth. Ashley cleared her throat. "Ben?"
"What?"
I was starting to get smoke and didn't want her distracting me.
"Ben?"
"What?" She pointed above the fireplace, off to a side shelf. A can of lighter fluid sat next to a box of strike-anywhere matches. I dropped the bow, grabbed the can, which was nearly full, quickly doused the wood and paper, struck a match, and threw it onto the wet paper. When I first took a job with the hospital and began making a doctor's salary, I started taking longer showers, even shaving in the shower. Admittedly, it's a luxury, but I love the steam in my lungs, the hot water on my back, and the way the heat allowed me to relax. We sat mesmerized and bathing. I was drenched. Every piece of clothing I had on was wet and cold. My hands were chapped, cracking, and the denim strips were torn and little good. I knelt, hands held out, and began peeling off the fraying denim. Neither of us spoke. With my hands free, I pulled off my wet coat and jacket, sat next to her, put my arms around her shoulders, and hugged her. We'd caught a break. In doing so, it pushed back the hopelessness that was crowding in, choking the life out of us. After the fire bled out the cold, I climbed the stairs and searched the bunks. All were empty except one. A single twin foam mattress, 6 inches thick and partially chewed around the edges, lay wedged and half-folded over in a corner. I dusted it off, beat it against the railing, filling the air with dust, dragged it downstairs, turned it over, and laid it in front of the fire. Napoleon immediately took his place at the end closest to the fire and curled into a ball. In the 3 minutes I'd been gone, the fireplace had heated the area around it. I pulled out my bag, laid it on the mattress, then unzipped Ashley's bag and slowly helped her lift herself from her bag to mine. She was weak and needed help to get across. I propped her head on my pack, unbuckled the leg brace, helped her out of her clothes, and hung them across a pew. With Ashley dry and warm, I started pulling off my wet clothes and spreading them across the pew. Then I dug in my pack and pulled on the only dry piece of clothing I had, a pair of jockey athletic underwear Rachel had given me years ago. She'd given them to me as a joke, but they functioned well. Then I eyed the kitchen. It filled an area of space to the left of the stairs and contained two large black cast-iron wood-burning stoves. A single black pipe led from the back of each and out through the wall. Several long preparation tables sat in the middle, and a long stainless steel sink lined the other wall, ending in a tall, white, gas-hot water heater. The whole thing looked like it was effective at serving large amounts of food for lots of people. I tried the faucet, but the water had been turned off, and when I looked beneath the hot water heater, the pilot light wasn't lit. I tried to shake the hot water heater, but it was full and wouldn't budge. I grabbed the matches from the fireplace, turned on the gas, smelled propane, and lit the pilot light. I stacked the stove with wood, lit it, and adjusted the damper to feed air to the fire. I filled a huge pot with snow, packed it tight and filled it again, then placed it atop the stove. On the far left wall stood a rather menacing-looking door. Large hinges, bolt and padlock, gave the do-not-enter impression. I pulled. No luck. I returned to the fireplace, grabbed a steel poker, which was every bit of 6 feet long and thicker than my thumb, and wedged it into the lock. I put my weight into it, pulled once hard, pulled a second time harder, then repositioned it and pulled again. While the lock didn't break, the hinge did. I swung open the door. On the left side there were a few paper napkins, a couple hundred paper plates, and maybe 1,000 paper cups. On the right I found an unopened box of decaffeinated tea bags and 1 2-gallon can of vegetable soup. That was it. I tied on an old apron that looked like it had been used at one time to clean the stoves and scanned the can of soup for an expiration date. Not that it really mattered, but it was still a few months from expiring. Ashley lay in front of the fire, propped on one elbow. 30 minutes later, she snapped her fingers, whistled, and waved me over. I stepped out of the kitchen area. Yes? She waved again. I walked within a few feet. She shook her head and waved me over. Closer. Yes? That is the sexiest thing I have ever seen. What, me? She turned up a lip, waved me out of the way, and pointed at the stove. No, dummy. That. I turned and looked at the kitchen. What? The steam coming off that pot of soup. You need help. I've been telling you that for about 16 days. An hour later, slowly chewing each piece of potato and savoring each chunk of steak, she looked at me, soup dripping off her chin, and mumbled, What is this place? I'd given Napoleon a bowl of soup with a few chunks, which he'd inhaled. He now lay curled up at my feet, contentment on his face. I shook my head. Some sort of high alpine camp. Boy Scouts, maybe. She took a sip of tea and turned up her lip. Who would make, much less drink, decaffeinated tea? I mean, what is the use? She shook her head. How do you think they get up here? Don't know. All this stuff had to get up here somehow. And I'm pretty sure they didn't stick those iron stoves on their backs and just pack them up here. When my clothes dry, I'll see if I can get into the other buildings, maybe find something. She took another bite. Yeah, like more food. 2 bowls later, we both lay in front of the fire, not hungry for the first time in several days. I held my cup in the air. What should we toast? She held out her cup, too full to sit up. You. She was still really weak. Tonight's dinner was good, but we'd need a few more days to start making up for what she and I had spent getting here. I stared out the window. The snow was falling thick, a total whiteout. I set down my cup, rolled up my jacket, and placed it behind her head for a pillow. She grabbed my hand. Ben? Yeah? Can I have this dance? If I try and move, I'll throw up all over you. She laughed. You can lean on me. I hooked my arms beneath her shoulders and lifted her gently. She slid up underneath me, finally standing. She wasn't too steady, so she hung on me, leaning her head against my chest. I'm dizzy. I moved to set her back down. She shook her head and extended her right hand into the air. One dance. I'd lost so much weight that my underwear was hanging low on my hips. Reminded me of some of the swimmers I'd seen. She was wearing a baggy T-shirt that needed to be burned, and her underwear sagged where her butt used to be. I held her hand and we stood without moving. Her head pressed against me. Our toes bumped. She laughed. You're skinny. I held her hand high, slowly walking a circle around her. I studied us in the firelight. My ribs were showing. Her left leg was badly swollen, nearly half again the size of her right. The skin was taut. I nodded. Eyes closed. She was swaying. She didn't look too steady on her feet. I stepped closer, wrapped my arm around her waist, holding her. She put her arms around my neck, wrapping them around my head. Her weight pressed down on my shoulders. She was humming a tune I couldn't understand. She sounded drunk. I whispered, "Let's not hear any more of this nonsense about me leaving you, going on alone. Deal?" She stopped swaying, turned her head sideways, ear to my chest. She let go of my hand and rested it between her chest and mine, pressing it flat. She was quiet several minutes. Deal. The top of her head came just above my chin. I leaned in, touched my nose to her hair, and breathed. After a few minutes, she said, "By the way," she threw her eyes at me and tried not to smile, "what exactly are you wearing?" The underwear Rachel had given me was bright neon green. They were meant to be supportive and fit more like athletic briefs or bike tights. But given my weight loss, they hung a little loose, now more boxer than brief. I'm always, or was always, making fun of Rachel and the underwear she chose to wear. I wanted Victoria's Secret, something with a little imagination. She liked jockey, all function and no form. One year for her birthday, I bought her this awful pair of granny panties. Couple of sizes too big, covered up half her torso. They were just gross. In retribution, she actually wore them. And to top things off, bought me these things. Ashley raised her eyebrows. They come with batteries? The laughter felt good. When Rachel gave them to me, she addressed the card to Kermit. I don't think Kermit would be caught dead in those things. Yeah, well, I wear them sometimes. Why? To remind myself. She laughed. Of what? Among other things, that I have a tendency to take myself a little too seriously, and that laughter can heal the hurt places. Then, I'd wear them too. She nodded and chewed on her bottom lip. Course, you might want to get a T-shirt that says, "Just say no to crack." When she grew tired, I laid her down on her bag, propped her head up, and poured her some more tea.
Drink.
She sipped a few times. I elevated the broken leg, hoping to alleviate the swelling. It needed ice. I needed to look into those other buildings, find some food, maybe a map, maybe anything. But I was dead on my feet. It was dark outside. More snow was piling up against the window, and the fire had heated me to my core. I pulled on dry clothes. Finally, I was warm and dry and full. I laid my bag out across the concrete, patted Napoleon, who was snoring, and lay back. I was dozing off when it hit me that during all that dancing, when Ashley's body leaned against mine, when the feeling of her as friend and woman had warmed me, that I hadn't once thought of my wife. I stood, crept barefooted to the door, and out into the snow, where I vomited from my toes. It was a while before I got up my nerve to talk. Chapter 31.
Kermit here. Ashley says my underwear looks like it came with batteries. Given my recent weight loss, they're a little big, hanging off my hips a bit. They weren't too flattering before, but they're no better now. At 3 months, the pooch started giving you trouble. I'd catch you staring in the mirror, looking at yourself out of the corner of your eyes, not quite sure what to make of yourself, hesitant to wear baggy clothes, but hesitant to wear anything tight either. Sort of that midway place. Not totally pregnant, but not pregnant either. A volleyball stuffed beneath your belly button. The Tom Hanks movie Castaway had come out, so we started calling the baby Wilson. Then it got really active, doing laps on the inside of your ribcage. You'd page me. I'd call you back from the ER, a blue mask hanging off one ear.
Yes, ma'am.
Wilson wants to talk to you.
Put him on.
You'd place the phone to your stomach. I'd talk to our son or daughter or whatever he or she was going to be. Then you'd tell me,
oh, I just felt a kick. I think we've got a soccer player in there. Or,
nope, nothing. Sleeping right now. 4 months in, I came home late on a Friday night. You were craving fried snapper. Hence our reservation at the First Street Grill. I found you standing in the shower, rinsing shampoo out of your hair. You didn't see me. I leaned against the doorframe, loosening my tie, taking it in. The whole wet, pregnant, glowing picture that was you and was mine. It was the sexiest, most beautiful thing I'd ever seen. You caught me looking.
You better not let my husband catch you looking at me like that.
I smiled. He'll understand.
Yeah? Just who are you?
I'm your doctor.
You are?
Yep.
Have you come to doctor me?
I smiled, raised both eyebrows.
I'd say somebody already doctored you.
You laughed, nodded. Pulled on my tie. Rachel, when I look back across my life and look for the one moment where all the good moments culminated into one, it was there. And if God would open up time, let me go back and live in one moment, it'd be that one. Well, the next one was pretty good, too. Chapter 32. Dawn outside. Day 17. New snow piled high. Pulling on warm, dry clothes was worth its weight in gold. Ashley lay sleeping. Her face was flushed and she was muttering in her sleep. But she looked warm and, for the first time in weeks, not uncomfortable. I found the lever on the wall that supplied the hot water heater with water, broke it loose, and turned it on. Brown, rusty water spilled into the sink. I ran it until it turned clear, then cut it off and turned up the heat. A bath sounded like a good idea. I slid the hatchet into my belt, grabbed the bow, and set out in search of the other buildings. Well rested, Napoleon beat me to the door, nudged it, and jumped out into the snow. In the fresh powder, he sank to his belly, then lay there grounded like a car stuck in ruts. I picked him up and cradled him. He growled at the snow as we walked. Flakes would land on his face, and he'd snap at them. I scratched his stomach and told him, "I like your attitude." The morning was crisp, bitterly cold, and in some places had frozen the top layer of snow, which I broke through, knee-deep with every step. I made a mental note to start thinking again about snowshoes. There were 7 buildings in all. One was a bathroom, split evenly between men's and women's. I found a few bars of soap and several rolls of toilet paper. None of the toilets or faucets worked, and if there was a water valve, I couldn't find it. 5 were cabins, 1 room A-frames, 2 stories, each with a wood-burning stove, carpet on the floor, and a loft. 1 even had a reclining chair. All were unlocked. The 7th was a 2-room cabin, maybe the scoutmaster's or whoever was in charge. The back room had 3 bunks, each covered with a foam mattress. A thick green wool blanket lay folded at the end of each bed. 6 in all. 1 even had a pillow. In a closet, I found 3 folded white towels and a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. The picture had been ripped off the cover, but I shook the box and it felt heavy with pieces. On the floor sat a steel lockbox, locked with 2 padlocks and secured to the floor. I hit it hard with the hatchet, busting 1 lock. I hit it again, busting the other. I lifted the lid. It was empty. In the front room sat 2 wooden chairs, a wood-burning stove, and an empty desk with a squeaky chair. I opened the top drawer to find a tattered game of Monopoly. It took 3 trips to haul everything we needed, including the reclining chair. I was closing the door on the 3rd trip when I noticed the most important piece. A bas-relief map hung thumbtack to the wall. It wasn't a map you'd use to navigate from place to place. Didn't even give distances. Was more like something put together by a city municipality advertising the natural parks or forests in its area and their proximity to nearby towns. It was a 3D map with raised, white-capped plastic mountains. Across the top of it read in large letters, High Uintas Wilderness. Along one side it read Wasatch National Forest, and in the right-hand corner were the words, Ashley National Forest. Fitting, I thought. A small dialogue balloon with an arrow pointed to the center of the Ashley. It read, Foot and horse traffic only. No motorized vehicles of any kind allowed at any time. Along the bottom, it read 1.3 million acres of wilderness excitement for the whole family. Evanston, Wyoming sat in the top left-hand corner with Highway 150 leading due south of it. In small letters across the highway, it read, Closed in winter. Around the edges were animated pictures of guys on snowboards, kids skiing, girls on horseback, a father and son hunting moose, couples on snowmobiles, and several hikers with backpacks and walking sticks. It looked like something you'd print if you wanted to advertise all the outdoor activities in your area. Interstate 80 bordered the top of the map, running west to east, from Evanston to Rock Springs. Highway 191 led due south out of Rock Springs to a town called Vernal. Highway 40 led west out of Vernal and ambled along the bottom of the map through several small towns before turning up, or northwest, and intersecting Highway 150, which ran north to Evanston. Somewhere in the middle of that plastic-capped mess inside the Ashley National Forest, someone had stuck a thumbtack, marked an X, and written, We are here, in black pen. I pulled it off the wall, and Napoleon and I returned to the A-frame and the fire. As we were coming into the building, Napoleon spotted something on the snow and took off after it. I never saw it, and he was gone before I had a chance to tell him not to. He ran off into the trees, snarling, his feet spewing snow. Ashley was still sleeping, so I dumped my goods, slid the chair in close to the fire, and checked the door for Napoleon. But all I could hear was a distant bark. I figured I didn't need to worry too much about him. Of the 3 of us, he was probably the most able to take care of himself. In one sense, we were holding him back. I returned to the kitchen and built a fire in one of the cast-iron stoves. The sink had been welded out of either stainless steel or zinc, and sat on legs as big around as my arm. The basin was deep and big enough to sit in. In fact, it was big enough for two people. The whole thing looked strong enough to support a house. I washed out the basin and filled it with water as hot as I could stand. When I sat in it, steam was rising off the top. It was one of the more magnificent moments I'd had in the last few weeks. I bathed, scrubbing every part of me twice. When I stepped out and dried off, the difference in pre- and post-bath smell was noticeable. I stoked the fire, added wood, increasing the heat, plunged our clothes into the water, scrubbed each piece, and then hung them over the pew. I poured two mugs of tea and returned to Ashley, who had just begun to stir. I knelt, helped her sit up, and she sipped, cradling the mug between both hands. After her third sip, she sniffed the air.
"You smell better."
Found some soap.
"You bathed?"
"Twice." She set down her mug and offered me both hands.
"Take me to it."
"Okay, but the hot water will increase the swelling, so we'll need to ice you when you get out. Okay?"
"Agreed."
I helped her hobble to the sink. She caught sight of her own legs and shook her head. "You didn't happen to find a razor around here, did you? Even a rusty one would do." I helped her sit on the edge and lowered her in. The water came up over her shoulders. Slowly, she bent her left knee, laying it flat across the prep area of the sink. She leaned her head back on the built-in dish drainer, closed her eyes, and held out a hand. Her finger hooked where the mug would be. I brought her a tea, and she said,
"I'll be with you in a little while."
It's amazing how a bath can improve your disposition. I walked off, turning just before I reached the fireplace, hollering back toward the kitchen. "Oh, and you'll never believe the name of the national forest we're in."
"Try me."
"It's called the Ashley National Forest." She was laughing as I stepped out the door. Chapter 33. Ashley's in the bath. I'm standing outside. The wind is picking up. I don't know if things are getting better or if we're just prolonging the inevitable. "So then you were 4.5 months. You were lying on the table and the nurse came in and squeezed the goo, as you like to call it, on your stomach and started rubbing it with the wand. I handed her an envelope and said, 'We'd rather you not tell us right now. We've got a date tonight, so if you don't mind, just write whether it's a boy or girl and then seal it. We'll open it at dinner.' She nodded and began showing us the head, the legs, even a hand. It was the most magical thing. I'd seen dozens, but none had ever affected me like that one. Then she started laughing. We should have picked up on it, but we didn't. I asked her,
'What?'
She just shook her head, wrote on the card, licked the envelope, and handed it to me, saying, 'Congrats. Mom and baby are healthy. You all have a fun dinner.' So we did. I drove you home. You kept asking me, 'What do you think, boy or girl?' I said,
'Boy, definitely a boy.'
'What if it's a girl?'
'Okay, girl, it's definitely a girl.'
'I thought you said it was a boy.' I laughed. 'Honey, I have no idea. I don't care. I will take whatever kid comes out of the oven.' Our favorite restaurant, Matthew's, catty corner to San Marcos Square. They seated us in a booth in the back. You were glowing. I don't know if I'd ever seen you like that. Ever. I don't remember what we ordered. I guess it was the chef's special, because Matthew came out of the back and said hello and sent us some champagne when he left. We sat there, champagne bubbles bubbling, candlelight flickering off your eyes, and the envelope lying on the table. You pushed it to me. I pushed it back to you. You pushed it back. I pushed it back and kept my hand on top. 'You do it. Honey, you've earned it.' You picked it up, slid your finger beneath the seal, pulled out the note and pressed it to your chest, laughing. Neither one of us could talk. Then you slowly opened the card and read it. I guess you read it 2 or 3 times because it was about 3 weeks before you said anything to me.
Well,
I asked, what is it? You laid the card on the table and grabbed my hands.
It's both.
Honey, come on, quit kidding. It can only be one. Then it hit me. I stared at you. Tears were streaming down.
Really?
You nodded.
Twins?
You nodded and buried your face in your napkin. I stood, grabbed my champagne glass, banged it with my knife, and spoke to the other 15 couples in the restaurant. Ladies and gentlemen, excuse me, folks, I'd just like to announce that my wife is giving me twins for Christmas. We bought champagne for the entire restaurant, and Matthew made his signature apple cobbler thing that just absolutely melts in your mouth. Everybody in the restaurant had some. Driving home, you didn't say a word. Your head was spinning with nurseries, colors, a second crib, a second of everything. We walked in the door and you disappeared to the bathroom. Seconds later, you called me.
Honey?
Yeah.
I need help.
I walked in to find you standing in your underwear and bra, staring in the mirror and holding a bottle of vitamin E oil, one hand on your hip. You handed me the bottle. Your job, from here to Christmas, is to make sure I'm not swallowed up in stretch marks and that my belly doesn't sag to my knees. So, get pouring. You lay on the bed and I dumped the whole bottle over your stomach. You screamed,
gross!
Honey, I'm just trying to cover every square inch.
Ben Payne.
I rubbed it on your stomach, your back, legs, pretty much any place there was skin. You shook your head.
I feel like a greased pig.
You do smell kind of funny. I remember the laughter that followed, and I remember sliding around. We had fun, didn't we? Somewhere in the hours that followed, you stared at the ceiling, 1 foot bouncing on a knee, and said,
"You thought about names?"
"Not really. Still getting over the sticker shock." You crossed your hands over your stomach, crossed the other ankle over the other knee, your foot dancing up and down, and said,
"Michael and Hannah."
The moment you said it, it clicked, like pieces of a puzzle snapping together. I rolled over, pressed my lips to your tightening stomach, and whispered their names. A soccer kick followed by a punch settled it. From then on, it became the four of us. Maybe that was the moment. Maybe if I could go back and start over, bathed in laughter, warmth, the crazy thought of two of everything and the slide and the smell of vitamin E oil, I'd go there. Because I'm pretty sure I wouldn't go much beyond that. Chapter 34. Napoleon had been gone a while, which had me a bit worried. When my clothes dried, I grabbed the bow, zipped up my jacket, and stepped outside. The wind was blowing over my back, out across the lake. I whistled, but heard nothing. I pulled my collar up and followed his footprints up a hill, then along a ridgeline overlooking the lake. The zigzag pattern told me he'd been chasing something. His tracks were hard to follow, as the snow was filling them. I crossed a second hill and saw him down near the lake, lying still in a red section of snow. I walked closer and realized the snow wasn't the only thing red. I knocked an arrow and walked slowly up behind him. When I got close enough for him to hear me, he growled, but didn't look. I walked around in a wide circle so he could see me. I checked the trees around us and over my shoulder. I spoke softly.
Hey, boy, it's just me.
You okay? He quit growling, but lay hunkered over what looked like a once white, now red, ball of fuzz. I knelt, several feet in front of him. Napoleon had not been attacked, but rather was the attacker. Part of a rabbit lay beneath him. couple of feet and a few bones were all that was left. I nodded, checking over my shoulders.
Good job, boy.
How would you feel about finding two more just like that and dropping them off at the big house up there? He looked at me, ripped, chewed, swallowed, snorted, and licked the sides of his face and nose.
I don't blame you. I'm hungry, too.
I stood up. Can you find your way back? Apparently feeling like I was too close, he picked up what was left of the rabbit and carried it further from me.
Suit yourself.
Walking back gave me time to think. While we were warm, dry, and protected from the elements, we needed food and a way out. Now more than ever. If I thinned it, the soup might last a day more. Beyond that, all we'd done was find a warm, dry place to die. I took a different route back, away from the lake. Several times I crossed moose tracks. More than one moose, and one larger than the other. Many times I crossed rabbit tracks, which are easy to spot because they hop, making a distinctive pattern. Moose are easy to spot because they're so big and pressed deep into the snow. I needed practice with the bow, but if I missed the target, the arrow would penetrate several feet down in the snow and I'd never find it. Wouldn't take me long to lose all the arrows. I returned to the A-frame, stoked the fireplace, and checked on Ashley, who was frolicking about like a dolphin, and told me to go away. I went to one of the other cabins and pulled up a piece of carpet. Back at our place, I folded it once, then folded it again, and then again. I laid that over the top of one of the pews and tacked a paper plate to the center of it. In the center of the plate, I cut a hole about the size of a dime. The A-frame room was more than 40 yards long. I only needed about 15. I counted off the steps, backed up, and drew a line in the dust with my toe. I knocked an arrow, drew, settled the sight, told myself, front sight, front sight, front sight, and then press. I gently squeezed the release, sending the arrow toward the target. It struck the paper about 3 inches above the hole. I knocked another and followed the same slow, easy movement. The second arrow struck just a hair to the right of the first. I shot a third arrow with the same result. I needed to make an adjustment, so I pushed the peep sight down. The peep sight was the little circle inside the string through which your eye looked. It required you to look from the same spot every time, making the release the same every time. At least in theory. Pushing it down would bring the arrow's impact down. It did. Just not far enough. I adjusted it again, bringing the impact too far. I readjusted and brought the arrow up. Within 30 minutes, I could hit the hole from 15 yards. Not every time. I'm not that steady. But every third or fourth shot, if I held true and still, I could hit the hole. Ashley had heard the commotion.
What's all that racket?
Just me trying to improve our chances of getting some dinner.
How about helping me out of here?
She'd washed her T-shirt and underwear and spread them across the dish drainer grooves behind her head. She reached out her hands and I helped her climb out. She wrapped a towel around herself and tucked it in the front like women do. Then she closed her eyes and reached for my shoulders.
I'm dizzy.
She leaned against me, trying to regain her balance. She spoke with her eyes closed.
I'm told you guys are visual. Seeing naked women excites him. So, how are you doing with all this?
I turned her and started leading her toward the fire.
I'm still your doctor.
You sure?
Doctors are human, too.
She was smiling, acknowledging the elephant in the room.
I can't get much more naked.
Her hands and feet were pruny, but she, too, was clean and smelled better. She toweled off, and I lifted her arm around my shoulder and allowed her to use me as a crutch. This time I got her to the reclining chair, which by its very design would elevate her leg, taking the pressure off it. I'd fed the fire too much, and the room was actually hot. I cracked the door to cool it off, which also didn't take long. She raised a finger.
Ben, You didn't answer my question.
Ashley, I'm not blind. You're beautiful. But you're not mine, I fed the fire. And I do still love my wife. She raised a finger.
I'm half naked and have been inside this bag since you put me here. I've seen you naked a half dozen times. Every time I go to the bathroom, you're literally right here, so how are you doing with all this? Is being this close to me difficult for you?
I shrugged. Honestly?
Honestly?
No.
She looked surprised, almost deflated. So, you're not excited by me at all?
Didn't say that. I can be plenty excited by you.
Then what are you saying?
We've all seen movies where two strangers are lost in some vast wilderness, and then, just like an officer and a gentleman, they end up rolling on the beach. Mad, passionate love that solves all their problems. Movie ends and they walk off into the sunset, weak-kneed and googly-eyed. But this is real life. I really want to get out of here and back home. And I want to do it with my heart intact. The part of my heart that needs to be filled with that has already been filled. By Rachel. It's got nothing to do with whether you could or couldn't, do or don't. So in all this time, from airport to plane crash to here, you haven't once thought about having sex with me?
Sure I have.
You're confusing me. Being tempted and doing it are two different things. Ashley, don't get me wrong. You're remarkable, incredibly good-looking. You've got the body of a Greek goddess, although I really wish you'd shave your legs. And you're certainly smarter than me. Every time we talk, I end up tongue-twisted and sounding stupid. But somewhere out there is a guy named Vince who, when I do meet him, is going to wish I'd treated you a certain way. And after I meet him, I'm going to wish I had. I would like to be able to look him in the eye and hide nothing. Because, trust me, hiding stuff hurts. I stared at her. When we get out of here, you and I are going to look back on this, and we're both going to wish I'd treated you a certain way. I want to be able to look back and know I did. I fumbled with my thumbs, nervous. I'm separated from my wife because of something I did. Or, put another way, didn't do. I'm living with that. Sex with you or anyone else could further that separation. And as good as that sex could or might be, it can't hold a candle to the pain of being separated. I try to remind myself of that whenever...
Whenever what?
Whenever I think something that your doctor ought not to be thinking.
So you are human?
Very much. She was quiet a minute.
I envy her.
You remind me of her.
How so?
Well, physically, you're lean, athletic, muscular. I imagine you could knock me out with one kick. She laughed. Intellectually, I don't want to argue with you. Emotionally, you don't hide from anything. You put stuff on the table rather than dance around it. Tend to face what's facing you. And you have a deep reservoir of strength, evidenced by your sense of humor.
What's her greatest weakness?
I didn't want to answer.
Okay, don't answer that.
What was her greatest weakness prior to the separation? The thing that's also her greatest strength.
Which is?
Her love, for me and the twins.
How so?
She put us first, always, making herself a distant third.
And that's a weakness?
Can be.
Is that the reason you guys separated?
No, but it didn't help.
What would you prefer?
I chose my words. I'd prefer she was selfish like me.
I grabbed a piece of plywood, 3 feet square, dusted it off, laid it flat across her lap, and handed her the box containing the jigsaw puzzle.
Found this. The picture's worn off, so I don't know what it's supposed to be, but might help occupy you.
She wiggled off the lid and dumped out the pieces, immediately flipping them over
and separating those with straight edges.